The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My head exploded when I started to read pre-Pearl Harbor history, the narrative of American exceptionalism, which was so powerful from the very beginning, was a very different kind of exceptionalism than the one that we're used to. You know, today, American exceptionalism is used to justify intervention and global engagement. For much of American history, it was the opposite. It was the United States needs to protect its exceptional experiment in liberty by keeping the outside world at bay.
I'm David Preece, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 13th, 2020. Many of us think of the story of the United States' interaction with the world as one of relentless expansion, growth, and engagement. From the early colonies, through the Spanish-American War, through the involvement in two world wars, and of course, the Cold War era, the story is one of America increasingly getting involved with the countries in its region and around the globe. Well, Charles Kupchan has a thing or two to say about that. He's recently researched and written the book Isolationism, A History of America's Efforts to Shield Itself from the World. I sat down with Charles in the virtual jungle studio to talk through this idea that, in fact, much of American history, in terms of its relations to the outside world, can be explained by isolationist tendencies, with only occasional bursts into more engagement, most notably in the Cold War world. But is that period coming to an end, and how does Donald Trump play into these trends? It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 13th. Charles Kupchan on isolationism. Charles, in this intellectual history of American isolationism, you really cover U.S. foreign policy from before the founding up into this year. How do you define isolationism to cover American foreign policy and national security across that wide of a time frame? What are you talking about here?
Well, I start off the book by defining very precisely what I mean by isolationism. And for me, isolationism is a strategic doctrine which basically says, do not extend America's strategic reach beyond the mothership. The mothership for me being North America. Because from the very beginning, the founders set their vision on expanding westward and making it to the Pacific, which is the question of when do you get there? And the big question was, do you go further than that? And over the course of the 19th century, right up until the Spanish-American War, the answer to that was no, we don't go further. And George Washington, in his farewell address of 1796, basically said the great rule for us, our grand strategy, is commercial connections with everyone, strategic connections with no one. In other words, we'll stay out of your hair, you stay out of our hair. Now, there are some historians who say, well, the U.S. never was isolationist because it was always a trading nation. And I agree that it was always a trading nation. But to me, that doesn't mean it was not isolationist, even if it sent out its navy to defend traders now and again. And others would say, well, how can you call the U.S. isolationist when it was very aggressive and, in fact, ruthless as it expanded westward, not only running over Native Americans, but grabbing a big bunch of land from Mexico. Mm-hmm. To me, that is expansionist. It is aggressive, but it is not isolationist in the sense that it was about domination in North America. It was not about extending the reach beyond the motherland.
Let me tease that out a little bit, because one could argue that not many countries, and we'll just go back to the 13 colonies becoming a country, not many political entities had that luxury, if you will, of being, quote, isolationist, because they had a continent and, in fact, much of a hemisphere to expand into. I guess the only parallel might be Russia with its eastward expansion across North and Northeast Asia. But pretty hard for a Germany or a France or an Italy to be isolationist in the same sense for the first 100-plus years of its existence in a crowded neighborhood. Here you have America, certainly not battening down the hatches and putting a wall around the original 13 colonies. I mean, the story of the first 100 years of American history is one of expansion, of fighting off the European powers, of fighting off native populations, of stretching all the way up to the Arctic Circle and the Aleutian Islands eventually. So push back against that argument that, in effect, America could afford to be isolationist by your definition simply because they could expand and expand and expand, and you're stacking the deck by putting the definition of isolationism to mean the North American continent.
Well, you know, I think that you are right to say that the United States had an exceptional allotment and that that helps explain its grand strategy, because there was an enduring geopolitical geographic logic to isolationism stemming from the fact that the United States had flanking oceans to its west and east and relatively small and benign neighbors to the north and south. And it's not accidental that other incidents of isolation around the world tend to be countries that are islands, even though the U.S. is a big island. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese went through a period of isolationism, and Britain engaged in what they called splendid isolation, which they meant staying out of trouble on the continent and focusing only on the empire. But motivating the founders from the very beginning was the idea that the 13 colonies and the United States as a whole could never be secure as long as it was threatened on its own continent. And therefore, there were two big strategic purposes during the early decades. One was to gradually push great powers away from the borders of the United States and ultimately out of the Western Hemisphere. And that's a task that worked because the U.S. wanted to, in the end of the day, be what Alexander Hamilton called an ascendant in the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And the other was to push westward and prevent Native Americans, the French, the British, anyone else who was there from threatening the United States over land. And so for me, the push to the west was about getting to a point where the United States could enjoy the natural security that came with its geographic allotment. And then the key debate was, do we stop there or do we keep going? That they spread westward was never in question. And to me, it was foreordained.
Let's put off for now the full circle treatment of this, whereby you're talking about the Trump administration and its return to some of the core principles driving isolationism, because you didn't start the book with Trump. What were you seeing back in 2012 when you started researching and writing this book to drive you to pull it together?
Well, I actually started to ruminate on the question of the future of American grand strategy in the 1990s, because I began to see a fall off in the interest of the American public and the American government in projecting power abroad. I served on the National Security Council in the first Clinton administration and saw the president very reluctant to get involved in the Balkans, even though he eventually did, both in Bosnia and in Kosovo. I began to notice that coverage of foreign affairs in mainstream media, both print and broadcast, was falling off a cliff. Then in 1994, you have the Republicans take over. And essentially, that's the end of what I would call the bipartisan center on foreign policy that came into life under Roosevelt and was really there as a backstop to American grand strategy right up until the end of the Cold War and the 1994 midterms. So that's when I first started to think that something was afoot and that the brand of internationalism that we grew up with, and I was, you know, born during the Cold War, came of age as a scholar before the Berlin Wall fell down. So that kind of engagement, robust, unstinting internationalism, struck me as fragile. And then you get 9/11, which essentially reinstates the U.S. enthusiasm for projecting power abroad. I would say perhaps too much enthusiasm. And that leads to the Forever Wars. And it was in reaction to the Forever Wars and the growing view that the U.S. has bitten off more than it can chew in the Middle East. That's when I said, you know what? I think what I saw in the 1990s is coming back big time.
Right.
And that's when I decided to go ahead and write a book about isolationism. And when I started to read pre-Pearl Harbor American history, my head exploded because I began to see a country that really, from a strategic perspective, looked nothing like the country I had grown up in.
Well, let's dig into some of that history and we'll just parachute into particular moments here and have you explain them to us. So early isolationism from Washington's policies and, of course, his farewell address, which you already mentioned, through the War of 1812 and up to the Civil War. What factors drove America to certainly expand during that time period, but to resist foreign entanglements and extensions beyond the continent?
You know, I may, if you allow me, start the story just a tad before you did and go back mm-hmm. to 1793. Mm-hmm. The farewell address was 1796, because there was an event in 1793 that I think speaks volumes. And that is that the United States in 1778 was getting its rear end kicked, to put it bluntly, by the British in the Revolutionary War. And as a consequence, the founders did something they didn't want to do, which is they formed an alliance with the French.
Right.
And the French came across and bailed the United States out. And probably the U.S. would have lost the Revolutionary War had it not been for France. Then in 1793, Britain and France go to war again. And the French call up George Washington and say, "Hey, George, we bailed you out when you were in trouble. We invoke the alliance. How many troops, how many ships are you going to send?" And George Washington issues the Proclamation of Neutrality, in which he basically says to the French, "Good night and good luck," and reneges on the alliance that had been formed in 1778. That was the last alliance the United States took up until after World War II. So that just gives you a sense, you know, 1793 until after World War II, we wanted nothing to do with being entangled abroad.
Let me ask you about that French alliance to follow up. How much discussion did you find digging back that there was about the tension between commitments overseas and the greater national interest of not getting tied up because of those commitments, because of that very treaty?
Well, that decision was hugely controversial, mm-hmm. and it led to a major rift among the founders. And Washington went back and forth in his own mind about how to handle the problem. And he ended up basically taking the middle course. Originally, Hamilton said, just annul it, just announce that it is dead. And instead of doing that, he basically said, we're going to uphold the alliance. We will honor the alliance, but we will maintain neutrality. So it was kind of a sleight of hand, and it nonetheless drove Jefferson and his fellow travelers crazy because they felt that we had sold out the French And they also felt that he didn't have, that the president did not have the constitutional authority to renege on the alliance because it was the Senate that had ratified it. So this turned into a huge row, and in fact was one of the reasons that Thomas Jefferson resigned as Secretary of State in protest over this decision. But you're right to point out, David, that part of the concern here was that the United States would unnecessarily get dragged into somebody else's war, and by hitching its wagon to the French, would end up compromising its natural security. So that was a big piece of it. And then I would say the other big motivators in those early days were, number one, freedom of decision, an early form of what came to be called unilateralism. Third would be fear, deep, deep fear among the founders that if the United States built a big army and a big navy, raised taxes, it would eventually slip into tyranny. The founders were very concerned about the fragility of America's democratic institutions, and they felt that entanglement abroad would eventually come at the expense of liberty and prosperity at home. They didn't want to go down that path.
Right. And that did provide one of the real reasons why, for the next 70 years or so, certainly up until the Civil War dominated what was happening in the U.S., why there was this isolationist trend. But there were some other factors, too. What else drove American leaders across several generations here to continue this isolationist trend?
Well, I would say that other factors would be race and racial tensions. Before the Civil War, there were discussions about expansion outside North America, for example, into the Caribbean, Haiti, Cuba. And always what sank it, or one of the factors that sank it, was that North and South could not agree whether any new territory would be a slave territory or a free territory. And as a consequence, that disagreement always created a veto. After the Civil War, the concern was the possibility of bringing non-whites into the body politic. And even though slavery was eliminated after the Civil War, there was concern that race relations in the country were so fraught and Reconstruction had gone so poorly and was so divisive that neither North nor South was particularly interested in bringing in a large number of non-whites. So race was an important part of this. And it also took on some form of xenophobia. By the late 19th century, anti-immigrant sentiment is an important part of the isolationist impulse. Another piece of the pie would be pacifism, especially in the North. The religious communities in the North, many of them were pacifists. They opposed the Revolutionary War. They opposed the War of 1812. They opposed the Mexican-American War. And they did so because they didn't believe in the use of force. A lot of this was kind of borrowed from Quaker traditions, but there was also a more secular version, which was that the United States was an exceptional nation. It was blazing a new path. It would operate according to Enlightenment principles, not the principles of the balance of power. And so that sort of ideological self-virtue also played a role in those who said that the United States should not expand overseas. And it all obviously created tension internally, because in many respects, the treatment of Blacks, the treatment of Native Americans didn't sit well with a country that saw itself as a chosen nation, the new Israel, a country that was breaking with the past and following a much more enlightened vision of its foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one moment most listeners will point to at this point and say, but wait a minute, there's the Monroe Doctrine. We have this statement basically saying, all right, Europe, you're out of the entire hemisphere. Talk about both the theory and the actual practice of the Monroe Doctrine and what it says about these isolationist impulses you just mentioned.
You know, I was quite struck when I started reading deeply into the Monroe Doctrine because, like you, I was led to believe that the Monroe Doctrine 1823 was kind of America's coming out party, mm-hmm. when the White House basically said, hey, this is our pond, get out of our neighborhood. And that's not what happened. Basically, what happened is that the British reached out to the U.S. This was in the wake of the unraveling of Spanish colonies in Latin America. And they said to the U.S., hey, why don't you and we team up to make sure that Spain doesn't come back and announce no new colonies in the Western Hemisphere?
Right.
And the U.S. said, you know what? We're going to do this ourselves. We don't want to be tethered to the United Kingdom. And as a consequence, Monroe comes out and he says, essentially, we will not abide by new European colonies in the Western Hemisphere. But it was mostly hot air. And for most of the rest of the 19th century, the United States didn't really lift a finger, even when European colonies did come back. And I'll just tell one quick story that illustrates how fraught this issue was. Soon after the Monroe Doctrine, this would have been 1826, there is a conference in Panama in which a number of the new republics were coming together to talk about their relations with each other and their relations with Europe, and the United States was invited. And the White House put together a delegation of two people to send to Panama, and Congress went nuts. They said, what are you doing entangling us in the politics of Latin America?
And this is just to attend the conference, right? This isn't about a commitment they were going to make. This is merely to show up.
This is showing up with a warm body. And others said it would be unacceptable, an abomination, to have our white Anglo-Saxon diplomats sitting at the same table with immigrants from Western Africa and Catholics and mixed races. We really have no business putting ourselves into that kind of environment. And eventually the Congress did move and the president was able to twist arms, but one of the delegates died before he got there, and the other got there so late the conference was over. So that just gives you some sense of how enthusiastic the polity was for engaging, even in places that were pretty close to home and seen as part of America's broader writ.
Sure. Now, you do note that as the decades go on, I think you wrote, it was inevitable that the United States would eventually seek to extend its geopolitical reach beyond the homeland. And of course, that does happen, especially in the decades after the Civil War and Reconstruction. You have the acquisitions of Midway, you have intervention in Samoa, you have the rights to the harbor in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor, and so on, from the late 1860s up to the late 1890s, eventually leading to 1898, the real watershed event for the United States on the isolationism versus interventionism scale, with the Spanish-American War and the acquisition of territories from the Philippines to Puerto Rico to Cuba. Talk a little bit about that moment, but more particularly, why didn't the United States fully embrace imperialism after taking that step and becoming, for the first time, in some ways, a global power?
Well, you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago that my head exploded when I started to read pre-Pearl Harbor history. And one of the reasons that I found it mind-bending is because the narrative of American exceptionalism, which was so powerful from the very beginning, was a very different kind of exceptionalism than the one that we're used to. You know, today, American exceptionalism is used to justify intervention and global engagement.
Right, right.
For much of American history, it was the opposite. It was the United States needs to protect its exceptional experiment in liberty by keeping the outside world at bay.
And how much of that, Charles, was a cover, maybe self-deception to some degree, maybe not, a cover for pure racism?
Well, the racial element was one part of it, but there really was a profound belief that the United States was different than other countries, and that it really was founded upon a set of principles that were novel, and it was a light unto the nations. So there was agreement from George Washington on forward that the United States should be a beacon, that it should use the power of its example to change the world. But when they talked about using more than the power of example, i.e. force, the answer was always no, because that would change us. That would make us just like everyone else. And if we're going to be exceptional, we cannot engage in this kind of geopolitical assertion that the rest of the world is so fond of. So that really is a kind of narrative that continues right through the 19th century. But you're right to say that you begin to see the light bulb go on earlier than 1898, because the U.S. does start fishing around for ports in Hawaii, in Samoa, in what came to be called the Midway Islands, largely because it saw its prosperity linked to trade across the Pacific. And as you start getting into the coal era, you need coaling stations. You need places for ships to stop and store up. So yes, there was the beginning of these efforts to find places to stop. But then the real turnaround comes in the 1890s. And it happens in two stages. Stage one is a decision in 1890 to start building battleships. And this was hugely controversial, because up until that point, the United States built only smaller, faster ships that were needed for coastal defense and commerce protection. And so when the administration said, we want to start building battleships, Congress said, for what? What are you going to do with them? Why do we need battleships? We're safe out here in the middle of the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean. So finally, they start building battleships. And then you see a kind of narrative emerge in the 1890s, especially after an economic downturn in 1893, in which the president, in which Admiral Mahan, who was a key person here, and Teddy Roosevelt, they all begin to talk about the closing of the frontier. And the degree to which, if the United States is no longer pushing its boundaries, it will lose its political and economic dynamism. That was really the ideological turning point when elites began to say to the public, it's time to take manifest destiny abroad because we've finished the mission here at home. And that was really the kind of ideological platform that McKinley used to launch the Spanish-American War. And this was in response to a bloody repression of Cubans on the island. And he said, you know, we have to do this for humanity. We have to go save the Cuban people from the bloody grasp of the Spanish Empire. And then, you know, while we're at it, as long as we're freeing the people of Cuba, let's occupy Cuba and Puerto Rico, and take Hawaii, and the Philippines, and Samoa, and the Wake Islands. And so suddenly, all overnight, Americans wake up with overseas territories. And then in the Philippines, an insurgency explodes. It is very bloody. 4,000 dead American soldiers, hundreds of thousands of dead Filipino civilians and fighters. And so Americans are saying, you know, wait a minute. You told us we were going abroad as an exceptional nation to spread democracy, and we just turned into an empire. And that really sets the stage for a backlash against the Spanish-American War, and sets the stage for Woodrow Wilson, who said, listen, McKinley's realism didn't wash. It's too based on interests and power and geopolitics. That's not who we are. And that's one of the reasons that he created a brand of internationalism that was much more idealist than realist.
So that's an interesting contrast, is you have the decision to take on these territories, which do require governance, which in some cases requires conflict. And Americans generally don't like it and shrink from that responsibility. Sure, they don't give the Philippines to somebody else. That wouldn't come until independence in the 40s. And yes, they hold on to Cuba and Puerto Rico and the others, but they don't seem to particularly like it. And then it takes Wilson, who somewhat reluctantly at first, but ultimately commits to sending U.S. troops to Europe in the First World War, but very different motivation there. His motivation is, we're going to have to do this in order to, number one, protect American commerce, yes, but also we're going to try to prevent wars from happening again. And we're going to use more of that idealist motivation rather than the pure realism that seemed in retrospect to underlie the acquisition of territories in the Spanish-American War. But it didn't turn out well. It certainly didn't lead the American people to get fully behind the League of Nations and a more activist role internationally. Why not? How did Wilson's idealist reformation of the anti-isolation principle fail to take hold?
Well, I'll start the story after Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's presidency. And he, even though he was more of an imperialist than President McKinley, he began to see that there wasn't domestic support for this ambitious American foreign policy that had taken shape. And so he starts walking things back, and then you get a dollar diplomacy. And that basically took the U.S. back to a world in which it was more focused on commerce than anything mm-hmm. else, with the exception of the Western Hemisphere, where we remained quite interventionist. And Wilson largely steps into that role, where he, despite his reputation as an idealist, was quite the imperialist in the Western Hemisphere, but not beyond. He really wasn't interested in strategic commitments in Europe or Asia. And I would remind everyone that from 1914, when the war broke out, until January 1917, Wilson wanted nothing to do with intervention in World War I, right? He was a hardcore isolationist. He used the same arguments that had been prevalent in the 19th century to basically say, we have no dog in this fight. We will stand aloof as an arsenal of democracy. Let them fight it out, and we're going to blaze a different path. Mm-hmm. So then in January 1917, the Germans start sinking American ships because Wilson declared neutrality, and he continued to trade with powers on the other side of the Atlantic that were at war with each other. And once American ships go down, then Wilson says, this can't stand. But you are right to say that he didn't justify the war on hardcore commercial or geopolitical interests. He justified it on idealist interests. And I'd encourage your listeners to go read, and it's available online, his request for a declaration of war. This would have been early April 1917. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable speech because it's all about American ideals, about human rights, about making the world safe for democracy. There isn't a whiff of geopolitics or American national interests. It's just not there. So then, you know, we go to war for this idealist goal of changing the world. He then spends most of the post-war early year, the 1919, in Europe, negotiating the League of Nations. He comes home to get it ratified, and it's rejected. So the Americans, you know, they said, what is all this talk of idealism? People are dying in the trenches in Europe. And then he comes home and says, well, we're going to remake the world, because we're going to stand shoulder to shoulder with everyone else and meet any aggressor with force. And the Republicans in particular say, what are you talking about? That violates the traditions handed down to us from George Washington and others, that we don't make alliances with anyone. And Wilson tried to get the League of Nations ratified three times. There were three separate votes in the Senate. All of them failed. And then he says, okay, well, it must be the Senate. I'm going to make my case to the American people. And he says that the 1920 presidential election will be a referendum on American internationalism. And the Republican candidate, Warren Harding, a senator, basically says, make my day. I'm taking you on. I stand for nationalism and Americanism. I am against the policies of Wilson and for the policies of George Washington. And Harding wins in one of the most lopsided elections in American history. And he wins on a nationalist, isolationist, unilateralist agenda platform. And that really sets the stage for the stubborn isolationism of the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, and that period really is what most people think about when they think about isolationism and why it is largely a pejorative term for many people because of that isolationist period in the 1920s, but particularly into the 1930s, setting the stage for the Second World War. And I believe you point out that in the 1930s, there was a shift in isolationism that took it even farther than in early American history, whereby earlier you had commercial engagement, but geopolitical detachment, or at least a lack of entanglement in foreign alliances. But then in the 1930s, that coupling was gone. It was severing both commercial engagement and the geopolitical commitments. Now, that obviously has a huge effect in history, also on policymakers for succeeding generations, because that is what isolationism means to them, the shirking of responsibility, the closing yourself off. It doesn't work. It leads to aggression. And that was a real defining moment because it also set the stage for what you call the longest period of American engagement with the world in its history that came afterward. Really interesting moment there, and you focus in on a few specific aspects of it. And I was hoping you could talk in particular to describe this real tension that's going on in the 1930s before, of course, the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the entry into the war. But you mentioned the Ludlow Amendment, the proposed amendment, and what that says about U.S. isolationism and its limits at this time.
Well, you know, I think that you're spot on to say that isolationism is a pejorative, it's a dirty word, it's an insult. And one of the multiple reasons I wanted to write the book was to say, look, hold on a minute. Strategies of detachment, non-entanglement has its time and its place, and it should not be written off. And I point out in the book, as we've been discussing, that it worked pretty well in the 19th century, in the sense that it allowed the United States to rise in an unmolested fashion, succeeded in pushing out great powers, allowed the U.S. to focus on domestic development. So you could argue that America's rise to greatness was on the back of geopolitical detachment. Now, you get to the 30s and isolationism runs off the rails and turns into, in my mind, a search, a deluded search for strategic immunity that deservedly made the word isolationist into an insult. And what happened in the 1930s is that, you know, you come off the 20s, which because of World War I and the failure of the League of Nations is a decade of what I would call isolationist internationalism. We're engaged in the world, but largely through economic engagement. I think I borrowed that from a historian named Christopher Nichols. I think he coined the phrase isolationist internationalism, but it's very good because we were internationalist. We were out there. We were trading. Wall Street was very influential in Europe and in Asia, but we were not engaging strategically. We were bringing the troops home. Then you get to the Great Depression, and isolationist internationalism turns into hardcore isolationism. One, because we're focused like a laser on the domestic agenda, and Roosevelt wants to avoid doing anything that could get in the way of the New Deal economically or politically. And then second, Americans, and this in part comes out of a set of congressional hearings, the Nye Committee, that looked into the causes of World War I, and they said, you know what, this was the arms industry This was the military-industrial complex pulling us into war. We're not going to let that happen. And so beginning in the mid-1930s, you see these tightening neutrality acts that basically said the U.S. is not going to allow what happened in January 1917 to happen again, i.e., we're not going to trade with countries at war because that could pull us into war.
Right.
And that's why you get, as you put it, not just geopolitical detachment, but commercial detachment. And Roosevelt, who is remembered as a great wartime leader, was really in the isolationist mainstream until 39, going along with these neutrality acts, wanting nothing to do with deeper involvement in Europe or Asia, despite the fact that Japanese and German aggression was getting bolder and bolder. And then finally, in 1939, he sees that Britain could fall, that the Nazis were growing in strength and growing in ambition. And so by the end of 1939, he convinces Congress to allow cash and carry. That is, that countries could bring their own ships, could bring their own cash, and could buy goods in the United States and take them home. But still no American ships, because we don't want them to get into harm's way. And then you get Lend-Lease in 1941, where Roosevelt started sending excess ships and aircraft and things over to the countries that are fighting fascism. But he says quite explicitly, I am doing this to keep us out of the war. I am helping others fight against the Nazis so that we don't have to do so.
And despite some tension among historians about that, you come down on the side that you think he actually meant that, right?
I was unable to find any evidence to the contrary. You know, some historians say that he was deliberately taking steps that would open a backdoor to war. Mm-hmm. That may be the case, but I think if it is the case, the responsibility, the onus falls on historians to come up with the memos, the letters, the insights to prove it. I simply did not emerge from my inquiry into that question convinced. And it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, he's fighting tooth and nail just to get cash and carry and Lend-Lease.
Yeah.
The America First Committee opens its doors in 1940. They oppose all of this stuff. Public opinion polls show that 80% of the American public was opposed to entry into the war. And so Roosevelt had his hands full just getting permission to provide military and economic assistance to those fighting the Nazis and the Japanese.
Sure.
You know, really, had the Japanese not attacked Pearl Harbor, not at all clear to me that we would have ever entered World War II.
And talk a little bit about two aspects of that in that period from roughly 1935 to 1941. First, the proposed Ludlow Amendment. What was that about and how did it reflect this feeling?
The Ludlow Amendment was basically a proposal that a declaration of war needed to be approved through a public referendum.
Wow.
And this was another effort to prevent the president or anyone else from going to war. The idea being, and its proponents said as much, that, you know, if the average Americans are going to be the ones that go off to die in battle, they should be the ones to have a say. And it was really quite a striking piece of legislation in the sense that it would have made it very difficult for the United States to get a declaration of war. And it wasn't the last time that these ideas came forward, but it was a sign of just how much reluctance there was in Congress and among the American public for going to war.
The second one I want to get your quick take on was the significant mass movement against this kind of activity that Roosevelt was leaning toward in 1940 and 41. Walk through briefly the principles and the short life of the America First Committee.
Well, the America First Committee came about in part in response to some of the steps that I just mentioned, that is to say, the loosening of the neutrality acts and the decision by Roosevelt to begin to make available armaments and other kinds of support to those fighting in Europe and in Asia. And they just felt that this is a crack in the door that will inevitably lead to war, and that the United States should learn the lessons of World War I, keep in mind the wisdom of the founders, and do nothing to threaten Western hemispheric isolation and security. And so they were dead set against any of these moves because they thought it was the beginning of a slippery slope. And to some extent, they were right in the sense that ultimately the United States did enter the war. But a large number of very prominent Americans, Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford and others, became prominent America firsters. Some of them were openly anti-Semitic and on occasionally pro-German. They opened chapters all over the country. They had the support of a really quite a striking number of Americans, and they were influential. They really did make life difficult for Roosevelt because it meant that even though he was not proposing to enter the war, when he moved forward with steps to provide further assistance, he had to fight his way through the public and through Congress at every step of the way. The America First Committee was very active, very vocal, and influential within Congress. In fact, some of its members were prominent members of Congress. So this really did create a pitched battle between the president and a very influential civil society group, which waged right up until Pearl Harbor. And immediately after Pearl Harbor, basically they said, hey, we're going to throw in the towel and get behind the war. But it wasn't until that point.
Right. And then, of course, we have the post-war system, which, again, our listeners know well, where suddenly the United States is engaged with the United Nations with an overwhelming supporting vote in the Senate. The Bretton Woods system, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, not to mention a series of entangling alliances from NATO through the Middle East to South Asia. And the few voices of isolationism were largely marginalized. But you mentioned at the beginning of this, Charles, that right around 1994, which you see as a real turning point, you suddenly start to see some of these previous threads of isolationism coming out in the differences that the Republican and Democratic parties seem to be taking towards America's international involvement. And that really gets us up to the modern day, because you write that Trump, in some ways, seems to be the poster child for resurgent isolationism. He's certainly talking the game. And you make the case that he does represent some of it. But so many parts of his rhetoric about isolationism and about focusing on America first do turn out to have been largely rhetorical. For example, publicly questioning if the United States would stand by its commitments to mutual defense under the North Atlantic Treaty, but not dropping out of NATO. Privately expressing to aides his desire to quit many alliances, but not doing so. Contemplating withdrawal, for example, from the U.S. Defense Pact with Japan, but not following through on this. How do you reconcile this seeming isolationist resurgence with the lack of any definitive rollback or disentanglement at that level?
Well, you know, I think that President Trump is tapping into a strain in America's history and its identity and its narrative, and that in many respects, he does seem to be trying to resuscitate the America First tradition of the interwar era. You know, and I was just struck when reading American history, how much of Trump's isolationist inclinations, the unilateralism, the protectionism, the racism, it really does resonate with a lot of American grand strategy prior to the war. But you're right that he has, to some extent, failed to deliver on the isolationist impulse, even though he has very much delivered on the unilateralist impulse. But I would say that the record is mixed. It's not quite as black and white, David, as I think you portrayed it, in the sense that if you look at the last year, I would say the one area where Trump has failed to deliver on his campaign promises is in this area of bringing the troops home. And you're right to say that the U.S. hasn't quit NATO, it hasn't pulled out of Japan or South Korea, but the president has been dead set to get out as much as possible of Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, and has announced the drawdown of U.S. troops in Germany. So I think that he has wanted to be able to say in the lead up to the election, I told you that I was going to downsize our commitments. I was going to lighten our load. I was going to bring our troops home. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm not a big fan of President Trump. In fact, I think he's taken the country woefully off course. But I do think that we have to harvest some lessons. And I do think that he is tapping into discontent within the American electorate on the question of excessive foreign commitments. And I would also point out that he's not alone, that the Democratic Party platform calls for getting out of forever wars and ending regime change. So that seems to me to be the trend line in American politics.
Mm-hmm. Now, to wrap this up, you talk about this, in a sense, return to isolationism in one form or another, and the fact that it seems likely at this point, right, that whether it's a managed process or whether it happens by default matters a lot. But you point out that it would be a grave mistake for the country to return to a grand strategy of North American isolationism, fully reminiscent of the 19th century. Why is that? Because some people think that pulling back that far might be the right thing, but why would that be wrong, and how should the U.S. do it in a better way?
Well, you know, one of the punchlines of the book is that we need to find the middle ground between doing too much and doing too little. Mm-hmm. We need to kind of step back, but not step away. And I do fear that we could overcorrect. And you now have prominent individuals, major figures in practice and study of international relations, who are calling for the United States to essentially pull back from Europe, become an offshore balancer, get out of the Middle East, return to some kind of more hemispheric focus. And my own view on this is that our main mistake has been taking on wars of choice in the Middle East and trying to turn Iraq and Afghanistan into Ohio. It hasn't gone well. We've been spinning our wheels. So what we need to do is to kind of refocus on our core commitments to Europe and Asia. And there I'm someone who thinks we should stay put for now. Number one, because Russia and China do constitute threats. And our overriding purpose since World War II has been to prevent the domination of Eurasia by a hostile power. I think that that is a guideline that still says we should remain a great power pacifier and deter Russia and China. And I also think that right now we're at a moment of real geopolitical flux and instability in both theaters, and an American withdrawal would unsettle everybody. It would embolden adversaries and unsettle allies. So I'm someone who believes that we can reduce our commitments, trim what we're doing abroad, and sustain our core commitments. But I fear that if we don't trim our sails, if we continue to overreach, then I do fear a more serious isolationist backlash. And I would point out that President Obama and President Trump have both tried to undertake that retrenchment. It's been very hard. And so one of the lessons I draw from the last two presidencies is we need to have a national conversation about how to do this right, how to find an American role in the world that does enough, but neither too much nor too little.
And that's a good place to end it. Charles, thanks for joining me.
Very pleased to be with you, David.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to rate the podcast, share the podcast, spread the word. Help everyone hear about the Lawfare Podcast. And don't forget to sign up on Patreon for our Lawfare live events starting this Friday with Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith answering your questions live about after Trump reconstructing the presidency. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo Studios was our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.